My name is Ray O'Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic. Very nice to be here in Orlando. I am a member of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. At Mamaroneck, you have all heard of that group, no doubt. And I bring you greetings from the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. They wish you a successful dinner. That authorization was given to me at a meeting of our steering committee last week, and the vote of our committee was 11 to 7. It was also nice to meet so many of the Al-Anon ladies when I came in here. I didn't think there'd be any Al-Anon ladies here. I thought they'd all be at a very important meeting of the Al-Anon movement, and being held this weekend in New York City. It's being held in the Mother Church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. I also bring you good news from the Walt Disney Organization. Charlie Lindenwall has just been appointed the eighth dwarf. He'll be known as Drunky. Let me tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. This is a thrill a minute, this is. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City. And my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you won't know anything about this in Central Florida, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people under the influence of alcohol. Now, this is a terrible thing to watch. And if you looked in my house, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker. And in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out as a drunk. So when I showed up at the local joint and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe coming by. I don't even recall what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it smelled. I liked the way it tastes. I liked what it did for my head. I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. I liked the Irish music and the fistfights. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. I was rolling through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all of the difficulties you might imagine a young boy would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was invited out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously set by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly put, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake in a small school in New England, I got a chance to leave the neighborhood, and I went north to college. And when I got up there, my drinking changed. In the neighborhood, we drank beer, and we drank shots and beers, and we call those bats and balls. But up north, they weren't drinking that way. There were no bars in that state, just restaurants, and you sat around at tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words of some of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over, and things were a little slow on the campus. And one afternoon, I went to get a haircut, and I joined the Navy. I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco, and I hate to be indelicate in such elegant surroundings, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and a new man slept on top. Take it easy, lady. Don't get ahead of me now. It's not easy, this, you know. I came back from my first liberty in San Francisco with all the beer that I could buy. And I went to sleep, and I had one of these nephritis attacks. And I met the fellow that slept below me that night. I suppose he expected to be wet sometime during his naval career, but it just hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. Sort of immediate seniority. One day, this mighty ship of the line was floating around in the South Pacific, bristling with armament, and we were delivering the mail, is what we were doing, bringing the mail to our fighting men. And the executive officer sent for me, and he told me something I was to hear many, many times in my life. It never helped with alcohol. In fact, if anything, it hurt. He said, "You are a very, very smart kid, O'Keefe." And I agreed with him right away. I thought he was beginning to show good judgment. And he told me if I would take some examinations, they would send me to a school. So I took these exams, and I ended up with a fleet appointment to the United States Naval Academy. And in a few months, I found myself in a very fancy preparatory school in Maryland. I was in the school about 3 months. Right around Christmas, the executive officer of the school sent for me. His experience must have been different than the other man's because he threw me out of the school. He said they had rules about people like me who went over the fence and came back drunk and started a riot and fist fights and things of that type. And he suggested to me that I return to the fleet. And in fact, he put his suggestion in the form of a written order. So being a well-trained military type, I packed my bag and I got ready to be sent far, far away. But with characteristic military efficiency, I was placed on board the yacht of the President of the United States. I would like to amuse you with tales of intimacy with the President and my participation in affairs of state. Unfortunately, I have no such report to make. It was still a Navy. I got paid, and then I got drunk, and then I waited to get paid. And then I got paid, and then I got drunk, and then I waited to get paid. And that's how I spent the balance of my enlistment. I came back home to the neighborhood. Everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was over the hill from the New York City Police Department, having invited a citizen of Puerto Rican ancestry off a five-story roof. The citizen bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. My brother Billy went west and went into another line of work. The 5220 Club was available for heroes. I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions, when I had one of those clear thoughts that come from time to time. I remembered I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there, and I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and I walked into a place, and there they were, sitting around a table, drinking beer out of bottles, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I got another pair of shoes, and I got collegiate all over again. And by now, a grateful government was sending me a check every month. So I was moderately solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. And I was staring around the campus one day in my usual shape, and I saw a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate. And my name was on the list. And that was good news. I thought I had another year to go. I notified the widow of this great event, and she came north, and that was a rather tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. About 10 years later, I served as a trustee of that college, and I'd go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not often in the state of Vermont they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. I came back home, and the question was, what was I supposed to do? And my uncles, who ran my family, ever since my father died, the uncles ran everything, and they had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman, because that's what my father had done. That's what my mother had done. That's what my brother had done. And that's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. And I told him I wasn't going to do that. I was going to do what I wanted to do. That's part of being alcoholic. I always did what I wanted to do. And I told him I had received a free ride to law school and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions. So I went to law school and things changed again. My drinking changed again. I didn't know much about lawyers or law school. I never saw a lawyer before I went to law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that has helped me so much, but I'll tell you, when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These guys were deadly. They all had on a blue suit, and they all wore eyeglasses. So you know what I did. As soon as I got into uniform and got a pair of glasses I didn't need, I looked around for someone to play with. My mother always told me, play with nice boys your own age. And nobody drank in that crowd. They're all studying. They're all grinding away. So I became the biggest grind I ever had in that place. And I didn't drink at all in my first year, and very rarely in the next couple of years. With the result that when I came out of school, I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. My superiors determined that I ought to be trained as a trial lawyer, so I was sent very early up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long when I discovered that all the wise guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I learned to drink in a different, in a more civilized, in a more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down bats and balls where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass, and you sip on that, and it gets the job done. It takes a little time. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the ritual that surrounds the very, very dry martini. And to this day, to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they destroyed me. After a little while of this civilizing influence, it became necessary in my natural development that I be married. And I had located a lady, or she had located me. I'm not sure how these things work. I met Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife. I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Found Mrs. O'Keefe my last year of law school when I was working in a hotel as a bellhop. I was a bellhop and she was a guest. And that pretty well characterizes the relationship right now. Mrs. O'Keefe is from a totally different background than mine. She was raised in a large home in Westchester County with devoted parents and servants and a fence and a dog. In a word, her family had a buck. And I drank an awful lot in those days, but I knew what was going on. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. There was only one fight. It was not a particularly good fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter. After that, we settled down and set up housekeeping, and Mrs. O'Keefe then began to produce children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion. And with the regularity that's known only to the devout Roman Catholic. And after the second or third of these wonderful events, I received a phone call one day from the dean of the law school that I had attended, and he invited me to come see him, and I went to see the dean. And he invited me to become a member of the faculty and become Professor O'Keefe. And I responded with great alacrity. And there I was, the boy professor. And I was very nervous about that job. I didn't know what there was in my background to justify it. And I knew I drank a great deal, so I thought I would control my drinking. And I entered into a controlled drinking phase, which was not at all successful. I was then 26 years of age when I had to control my drinking. But after I'd been teaching for a few years, I wasn't worried about the teaching anymore, so I went back out to drink the way I liked to drink. In fact, it was the only way I knew how to drink. My father died when I was 2, and my brother Billy taught me all of the good things of life, including how to drink. I drank like my brother Billy. I drank until I fell down, or until the cops came, or the place went on fire, or something happened. I would see people leaving, and I would wonder where they were going. I knew the whiskey was right there, and they would be going in a different direction. So I rolled around the city of New York. I did an awful lot of things in those days that are no longer important. I served by appointment of the governor of the state of New York in a number of capacities. I was teaching. I even ran for office one time and lost. I did all of those things that lawyers do when they're rolling around. The only thing I look back on with any degree of satisfaction is that I was among a group of men who very early surrounded the candidacy of a young senator from Massachusetts that you will remember. And in this period of time, too, Mrs. O'Keefe and I bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village called Larchmont, New York, a village which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we had it up to 5 or 6 children and a big house and the usual number of motor vehicles and the usual memberships in the usual obscure clubs. And I was working and teaching, politicking around. And had you asked me how I was doing in those days, I would have told you I was doing very well. In fact, whether you asked me or not, I would have been delighted to bring to your attention my version of the American dream. Truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I had become a terrific daily drunk. And my day would have killed a lesser man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet bed because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years. And I would struggle out of that damp sack, and I would begin my morning calisthenics. My calisthenics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I would have all the water running, the water in a shower, and the water in a tub, and the water in a sink, because I did not want Mrs. O'Keefe and all of those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would struggle downstairs, much like Santa Claus, with a sack of wet laundry over my shoulder, because Mrs. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children, and she did not think a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. So if you can imagine a man of my stature starting off each morning with a load of wash, but once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I would take a few bangs on daddy's juice, and then the question was, would I throw up in front of all those people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. Sooner or later, I would get into Grand Central, and there help was at hand, because Grand Central, if you know anything about New York, is not really a railroad station. It's a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I'd chair around the tunnels and pop up like a mole here and there and have a few. Sooner or later, I would get to the law school, and as soon as I got to that imposing institution, my first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out, and I'd tear across town, and I would steal. Every morning, I would steal $20 from the petty cash in a law firm, and then I'd be out and running into a taxi and down where I really belonged, the bar room down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like some kind of a mascot or a playmate, and I'd run in, and I'd throw up some dough, and I'd buy one, and they'd buy one, and a bartender would buy one, and maybe we'd talk a little business, and maybe we wouldn't, and maybe we'd settle something, and maybe we wouldn't, and maybe we'd have some lunch, maybe we wouldn't. But the constant thing would be the booze would keep coming, and I had it figured out that I was particularly brilliant at about 2 o'clock. So I had scheduled all my classes for 2, and I'd be in another cab and up to the school, and I'd inflict myself on those poor, unwilling sophisticates who had come to study law at my feet, and I would shortchange the kids, and I'd be out of there and into a cab over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12, and I would take a train going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont. North was good enough for me. And I got to see a lot more of Bridgeport, Connecticut than any civilized man ought have to. Sooner or later, I'd arrive home, and I'd bounce off a few walls and take what was left of Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old cheese glass that some kid had left laying around, and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one who drank in that house. So I'd have a number of pops, and then I would eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car, or puking on some hostess's sofa, or playing a little grab-ass with the ladies of Larchmont, and a sorrier-looking crop you have never seen. Most evenings, I would just stay home and vegetate. And I'd watch television with one eye like this, watching those sets come together. And I would drink, and I'd watch TV with one eye. And I'd go through the programming, and through the news, and through the late show, and on into the morning. And then my big moment would come, when they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi, and I would, and the destroyers would come through the water, and the planes would fly by, and I would weep and cry and sob, and then I'd go upstairs and wet the bed. That was it. Now, this is not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends, I would say, for binges. And if everybody around me would mind their own business, which was very rare, I could get drunk 3 times on Saturday and 3 times on Sunday. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she's a woman, and women don't know anything. And secondly, she's not an attorney, and I would tell her that. I don't think she really knew that, but I used to tell her that she was not an attorney. And then we would have a long discussion, and I would say, now, wait a minute, wait, you know, you get so excited. I don't drink that much. I would say to her, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much. And I'd be right out the door. And all this drove her wacky, and she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And this explained her condition, and so he sent her with a message to me. And we lived in a house, and it was very nice, that semi-so-forth-and-so-on house, and it had a nice room in it then. We don't live there anymore. We had some more children. We childrened ourselves out of that house. That's a polite expression to tell you how we came to move. You got to stay with me now. I'm going much faster, you notice that? And on the wall of this den, I had erected a shrine. Now, this shrine was not to any saint that you ever heard of. This shrine was to me. And there were pictures of O'Keefe with the great and the near great, and there were diplomas and plaques and proclamations and mementos of political campaigns and letters, you know, Dear Ray, best regards, Jack, that kind of stuff. And I watched the television with one eye, and I would drink, and they'd put on a commercial, and I'd look up at the wall, and I'd say to myself, you are some piece of work, and I'd have a few more. Well, Mrs. O'Keefe came to pay a visit to the shrine this evening, and the message she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor, as an alcoholic. That was bad news. And I rose to defend myself, as was my custom, and I started the argument, and the first point I made, I thought, still think it's a pretty good point, I took a very dim view of doctors who would diagnose patients without having seen them. I was against that practice. And then I went into high gear, and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a very, very fast rate. And then it happened. And I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I just can't explain it. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk that I'm giving now. But in the middle of all of this noise and confusion and yelling, I suddenly stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I had admitted to anyone, that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error, because 3 days later I found myself a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I'd only been there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. And I was overcome with great feelings of outrage and self-pity, because in addition to these outrageous circumstances in which I found myself, it happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing by, and I very carefully, I thought, explained to this cretin that on that very day, I had attained age 35, and therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said that there were two other presidents in residence. Jefferson and Washington, I think. And he went away and he left me. And I spent the next week or so doing all of those wonderful, warm, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook. I sweat. I did everything else terrific that you can think about. And I finally came up for air, and I was visited by the staff of the hospital, and they, of course, were psychiatrists. And the first one in to see me was the head of the hospital, and I would have expected no one less. And he fixed his cool, professional glance upon me, and he asked me that question that so many people insist on asking alcoholics. It's such a brilliant line of inquiry. He said, "Tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much?" So I told him. I told him about my wealthy parents. I told him that Mamsie and Dada used to travel a lot, and I had been left in the hands of cruel servants who were black. And he was very sympathetic, and he left. And about an hour later, one of his colleagues came in and asked me the same question. So I told them, after all, one shouldn't lie to a professional. I told them of my impoverished youth. I told them of the beatings I had received at the hands of my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck when I was 3 years of age. He said I had come to the right place. He said that help was at hand. He said with his help and with the help of medical science, one day I would drink safely again. And I said, thank you, doctor. He was my kind of a doctor, that doctor. And the last psychiatrist in to see me, and the last psychiatrist I have ever seen, with the exception of one I drive to meetings now from time to time, who got himself locked up last Saturday. This last one was a gentleman of dubious medical qualifications and a pronounced Middle European accent. And he was fascinated by two things. One was my professorial status, and the other was the fact that I was wearing sneakers in January. We had a long chat about the footwear. He found some mysterious significance there that had escaped me completely until he mentioned it, and we had a long chat, and he finally popped the question, so I told him. I gave him a sexual aberration that drove him out of the room. He thought he had been given a great degenerate to work with, and perhaps he had. Well, I wasn't as smart as I want everybody to think, because they had a staff meeting, and they came to the conclusion that there was a fraud in their hospital. And so they sent for poor Mrs. O'Keefe, and she came up through the snow and the ice, and I was brought into a room almost as big as this, and she was in the middle of it, hysterical. And she told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. For non-cooperation. I said, let's go. And she said, no, no, you stay. So I stayed. And I was playing Monopoly with a few guys who were there, not for alcoholism. They were just there, these guys. And we had this Monopoly marathon going. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do pretty well. So I had the boardwalk, had a number of hotels. I was doing fine. And I was into about the second or third day of the Monopoly thing, and they told me I had another visitor, so I went to my room and I waited. And through the door of that room came this very imposing-looking guy, and he told me that he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the hospital had asked him to speak to me of this program. And I went right at him. I said, alcohol, what are you, out of your mind? And I started. And he told me to shut up. Well, I was very sure that he did not know who he was talking to. So I continued to speak. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. He was an imposing-looking guy, and I was not a well person. So for the first time in 35 years, I sat down, and he began to explain to me, as I have been trying to indicate to you, what his life had been like, how he had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, you mean outside to meetings? He said, outside. I said, I'll go. Besides that, he gave me matches. And nobody else would allow me to have any matches. So that's how it began with me. He started driving me all over, and he made arrangements for me to go locally when I came out, and I began to go locally, and I don't remember so much of all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything, and the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they insist on giving alcoholics. I was dealing with that segment of the medical profession that considers the disease of alcoholism to be some type of a Valium deficiency. So my head buzzed a lot, but I know myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your chairman. I was always chairman whenever I joined anything. I would serve a term as your chairman. You would give me a plaque. I would hang it on the wall of the shrine. And that's up. That's all. Onward and upward. Well, it didn't work out that way. And it should come as no surprise to you, although it's a terrible shock to me, to find out some 10 months later I was very, very drunk. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power that is in our program. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time. And I won't take you through it because it takes too long and it still gives me the willing. Just let me say to you that it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I would drink a week and then I wouldn't drink a month. I would drink a month and then I wouldn't drink a week. I never knew at the beginning of the day whether I'd be drinking at the end of the day. I never knew once I began drinking where I would be when I was finished drinking. I would go to the meetings and then I would drink, or I would drink and go to the meetings, or I would just stay home and drink. And things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time that I no longer consider significant. I do not speak to you now of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not speak to you even of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but this is not what I am speaking to you about. I now speak to you about is that I can see that what was happening in my case, and perhaps in yours, is that there was in me a terrible, terrible wasting of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat, and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was now, for all practical purposes, extinguished, and I knew it. And there was nothing that I could do about it. It wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I had a memory. I knew what happened to members of my family. I had been to the funerals. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I drank. But there was nothing that I could do. I had been here, and this didn't work for me. And by this time, I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the hospitals and through the drying out places and through the sanitariums. And I've been through the jobs and the money, and I've been through my friends, and I've been through my wife's clergy, and I've been through the doctors and the nurses and the therapists and everybody else. And I've been up and down every avenue that was available to me, and I continued to drink. And I never thought it would end. And if I gave it any thought at all, I thought, well, this is the way it is with me. And if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. And I would continue to drink. And it is true when I say that I had no idea how it would end. But my day came. My time came one day. My time came. I say to you, and it's simply my opinion, that there is a time for all of us, and there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere across which we are simply not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we simply are not permitted to sink. And I say to you that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where that line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is a personal and individual thing. And for some of us, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. I received a phone call one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis. And the man told me that my brother Billy had died that night of alcoholism in the Veterans Hospital, where he had been taken from the Skid Row of Minneapolis. And so my brother died far away, without family, without friends. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And for other people, it can be something very trivial. But the line is there, somewhere. And I came to it on a day that really wasn't so different from any other day. I was 3 or 4 days away from a drink. I was in what then passed for my office. I was nervous and sick and thirsty. I thought I'd go get a drink. I knew that would help. But instead of that, I did something I had not done before. I called a longtime friend of mine who was a longtime member of this program. And his name is John, and he is my sponsor. And John came over, and he came into that room, and he looked so good. And I felt so bad. And I asked him what I would have to do to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John gave me that look that he has, and he said to me, "Don't drink and go to the meetings." Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him I didn't want him to tell me that. That was much too simple for a man like me. And I said, "You see, John, what you really don't understand is the real problem is where I work, this place here." And he said, "Yeah, sure. Well, don't drink and you go to meetings. I'll be all right." I said, "Now, John, at home it's worse. You know, I can't go back up there anymore." "Sure," he said, "just don't drink and you go to the meetings. You'll be okay." I said, "Now, I got this financial problem with Bankers Trust, John." And John said, "Well, don't drink, and you go to meetings. That'll be all right. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did John, because he put me on a train to Larchmont. He made a couple of phone calls, and he took me up to Grand Central, and he dumped me on this train. It's about a 40-minute ride, and halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand. What did I call him for? Huh? I must have panicked. What the hell does he know? Nothing, huh? Don't drink, huh? Don't drink my ass, don't drink. Wait till this train stops. And the train stopped at Larchmont, and I got off the train. And on the platform of the station was my mailman, a guy named Al, who was then chairman of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. And Al said, get in the car. And I said, get out of here, Al. You're going to hang around with mailmen. Tell me about you from New York. Get in a car. Well, a man of my stature cannot afford to have a fight with a mailman, or anybody else, for that matter, without getting killed. So I got in Al's car. And I said, Al, I'm in a lot of trouble, Al. And Al said, well, don't drink. And you go to a meeting, you'll be all right. So if any of you are foolish enough to ask my advice, since I'm an expert from my town, don't drink. You go to meetings, you'll be all right. And Al took me for a ride and came back that night and took me up to the world-famous. And I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. And sometimes it seems a long time when I'm not thinking properly. But first I had that day. And I had that day because two members of our fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of our... that they took what God sent that day. A drunken, dishonest, arrogant hulk of a man. And because they were grateful for what they had received, they gave me that day. And it is, I hope, that same sense of gratitude which allows me to be with you this evening. Because like Al, and like John, and like every member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a great debt to pay. And this is one of the ways that I do that. Well, I had that day, and I had other days, and I would see John every day, and see Al every night, and I would get my instructions. One day John said to me, you know, Raymond, he said, you've been hanging around pretty good. You don't drink, you go to the meetings. He said, there's more to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's more than just not drinking. He said, you have to learn something about the program. He said, you have to read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I'm the way I am, I said, what are you kidding me, John? Really, have we seen anyone fail it was thoroughly? And John gave me that look. You know that look? The look that long-time members of AA reserve for smart-ass people. John said, read it again. And I said, yes, John. Because by that time, my sponsor had taken me to the point where I hope your sponsor has taken you, where no matter what he said, ultimately I would say, yes, John. And so I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was appalled at my initial ignorance. I didn't know that the book had been written some 5 years after Bill had met Bob, and that 100 or so men and women had become sober before the book was written, and that the book is nothing less than a chronicle of the early members of our program I did not understand or appreciate that the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book were steps literally taken by these men and women as they became sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that if I said to you my name was Ray O'Keefe and that I was an alcoholic, but I was doing something about the first step of this program. Of course, that's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. But the men and the women who founded our program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable. And their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. They were powerless. They had no power. There was no way that they could control their relationship with alcohol. It says in our book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his incapacity for power. He lacks power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink, and time began to pass for them. Time has passed for me, and time has passed for this intergroup dinner. And if you come here new, time will pass for you. And time has this wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual observation that they made, or an offhand reference that they shared. They believed this. They really believed that there was a power greater than their own. And as they believed, I believe. And so firm and so true and so real was this belief that they were able to make a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power, this God, as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of this country when no one else had this notion, they conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they stopped drinking, they found that their bodies responded quickly. And when they came to believe, they began a mental recovery. It was slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could notice it. And when they made that decision, well, when they decided to turn over their life, that wasn't so much their lives. They had already admitted that their lives were unmanageable. But the decision to turn over the will, the alcoholic will, that thing, that was the thing that had me in all of that trouble for all of those years. I was what the book describes, an extreme example of self-will run riot. But when they were able to make that decision, when they were able to surrender, when they were able to truly let go and let God, they began not only a spiritual recovery, but they set down the basis for a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they knew, too, that it wasn't enough for them to simply stop drinking and start praying. They knew that if they were to be successful, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They sought to discover the exact nature of their wrongs. I was the kind of a guy that made sure that everybody standing at the bar knew who I was. And I made twice as sure that nobody at the bar knew what I was. And it was a great relief for me to go through this inventory process with my sponsor. And when our founders had finished their inventory, so great was the love and the affection of these people, one for the other, that they were able to readmit this inventory to themselves, to discard of their understanding, and to someone else. And I took my inventory to my sponsor, and he made more exact the exact nature of my wrongs. And then they developed an attitude which came very hard for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And then with compelling logic, they went to God and they humbly asked him to remove these defects of character, to remove these shortcomings. And it began to work for them. They knew, too, that they hadn't come here alone. They knew that in their lives, as in mine, there was a certain amount of baggage and of wreckage. And they knew that they would have to do something about it. So they made a list of all the people they had ever harmed, and they became willing to make amends to everyone on their list. And they didn't just talk about it. They went out and they did it. And you may remember when Dr. Bob took his last drink. He spent the day after work driving around Akron, Ohio in an old Buick. And when he got back, Bill asked him where he'd been. And he said he was out mending fences. It was the first day that he began to stop drinking. And he was making amends. And I don't think we need wait so long in our program to do all of the things that are expected of us. And it says in our book that following this ninth step, it says that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and know happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us that which we could not do for ourselves. And the book continues, are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are happening among us every day. And these were the promises that are in our book that came to our founders and come to each of us following that ninth step. And because of all of that and everything that had gone before, these people, these founders, these men and women knew that they had been given something very, very precious. And so they resolved that they would maintain it. And in order to maintain it, they continued to take personal inventory. They knew they could not afford the luxury of a resentment. They knew they could not be resentful or hateful, because if they were resentful, they would drink. And for them to drink was surely to die. It was very simple for them. And so when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so great and so true was their reliance upon this power greater than their own, that they sought to improve their conscious contact with this power, and they did that by prayer and by meditation. They prayed, and they meditated. They meditated, they gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine and very excellent form of meditation. It is a form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they believed in would speak to them. And this power that they believed in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And then they prayed. And no one needs a sermon from me on the value of prayer. When they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. And I don't know how it was with you, but lately I've been thinking, and it seems to me that all of my life I felt as though I was in the wrong place. I felt in the wrong family, in the wrong neighborhood, in the wrong school. I felt a man out of space and a man out of time, and perhaps out of the wrong century. All those years never seemed to be where I was supposed to be. And in the 12 and 12 and the 11th chapter, it says when they developed the habit of prayer, a great sense of belonging comes to us. We no longer live in a completely hostile world. We are no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. The moment we catch even a glimpse of God's will, the moment we begin to see truth, justice, and love as the eternal values of life, we are no longer deeply disturbed by all the seeming evidence to the contrary that surrounds us in purely human affairs. We know that God lovingly watches over us, and we know that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And a little later in their development, they came upon another prayer, and they thought it would help them, so they appropriated it. And the only thing they asked when they prayed for themselves, the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And you and I have already prayed that prayer this evening. They asked God to grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened to them. Something has happened to me. Something happens to everyone who comes here and puts this program into their lives and puts their lives into this program. There was a great difference in these men and women. There was a great difference between being drunk and being sober. There was a great conversion of their values and a great substitution of their standards. And this difference in them, the difference between being drunk and being sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had that spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were hopeless and helpless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to save life. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. And the only thing they were using was that great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in May of 1979 in this Baghdad by the castle. And that, my dear, dear brothers and sisters, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew what my sponsor knew. They know what my friend Mary knows, that there is so much more to our program than a simple device to keep me from drinking like a pig. They knew that what had been given to them was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy their new way of life, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. And so where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried to be honest. They tried not to be so arrogant. Happily for me, and perhaps for all of us, as Janet read, they said, we are not saints. They said that this was not a program of spiritual perfection. It is a program of spiritual progress. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe that I can progress in this program if I don't drink and go to the meetings. I could keep you for many, many, many more hours just to tell you of all of the good things that have come into my life, wholly, solely, and simply, because I am a member of the world-famous American group. But I would not keep you that long. If you have a good wish for me, and I'm sure you do, please be assured that anything that you might wish for me has already happened in my life. Only, solely, and simply because I am a member of this fellowship.
Everything that has happened to me, and believe me,
everything
good has happened to me. I've just finished my second term as a judge. I have recently begun to teach law. I taught a class for the first time in 16 years 2 weeks ago. Every area of my life is just terrific. Because and only because of our fellowship. I would be very remiss if I didn't
thank whoever it was who had the good sense to invite me to come back to Orlando
and to be with you and to see so many of my good friends again. As you probably know, I'm one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who are allowed to travel extensively in the program. And everywhere I go, I say basically the same thing. And every time I end, I say exactly the same thing. And I'm ending now. And I refer you to a pamphlet that we have in our program, and it's called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical turn, and he reminds us of the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him a while. And they finally asked him the question. They said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one we've been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really didn't answer that question, but he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. And tell John that the lame walk, the blind see, and the deaf hear, and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everybody knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk, and the deaf can hear, and most certainly the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of our program brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Thanks.